That's
very
okay.
Smoothly.
There we are. Okay, so introducing the topic of comfort rooms. And we're hearing from Gloria and Jessica from U Incorporated in Massachusetts. You have blazed the trails for many of us in the transition from seclusion to timeout rooms to comfort rooms. So I'm just going to open it up to you, and then maybe we have a little bit of time for questions at the end of your presentation. So thank you and welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. For people who don't know, I'm Gloria Kazakoff, and I'm the campus administrator and one of the assistant directors for residential care at UInc, and Jessica is our director of occupational therapy at UInc. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the process of sort of like introducing the comfort rooms and OT to our staff and sort of the process and what that was like and how we got staff to buy in. And then Jessica will talk more about sort of the process of how we actually created the comfort rooms and sort of different supplies and products and, how we keep them maintained and how we keep staff invested in OT at UInc. So just talking a little bit, we began by introducing OT to staff, I would say, through trainings and doing a lot of trainings and staff meetings and introducing them to the idea of OT. At the beginning, I think there was a lot of hesitation. So for people who are, just starting the process, I think, it's expected that there are some fears and hesitations. Some of the fears and hesitations that came up for us were things like if we touch the kids, then they will accuse us of abusing them. If we give them heavier weighted items when they're mad, they're going to throw them at us or break windows and things like that. And the idea that, like, OT is something that only an occupational therapist can do and that they have to do it in their office one-on-one with kids, and that it isn't something that, a typical line staff can really learn how to do. So we worked with them in the trainings to sort of put some of these fears and hesitations at ease, and we talked with them about, their fears and that these were, things that I thought we could overcome. But I think the point where we really hit, really sort of made a difference was when we, at each of our programs, I think, had at least one youth that they could identify that OT worked really well with. And each kid, I can think of the exact kid I know at Cottage Hill where I work that really made a difference and made staff start to say, wait a minute, this OT thing really does work. The kid that I'm thinking of is a kid who, she was a teenager. She had a really significant history of trauma, and at Cottage Hill when she was with us, she often would seek out restraint. She would ask staff, please restrain me. I need to be restrained. I need you to restrain me, and when we would refuse, she would end up acting in really unsafe ways that ultimately would result in a restraint. And when in restraint, she would end up having these really intense flashbacks that weren't good for the staff and weren't good for her, and she would be really, really aggressive, and she was a big kid, so she could really do some damage and hurt people. Jessica really helped us, I think, at that point, and she came in and she talked with us about the need for OT with this kid. We put her on a sensory diet. We put her on an OT plan where we used things like deep pressure and weighted blankets and body socks and weighted balls and all of those things when she felt like she needed a restraint instead. And then we also would try just implementing those into her every day and having her use OT for a certain amount of time every day. I would say even after a few weeks of doing this with her, she stopped asking for restraints and instead she started asking for OT. And I think that's what really made a big difference for the staff is they started to see these specific examples of kids where it made such a big difference and it made things a lot safer. So staff really started to buy in and they really wanted to learn more. We started teaching them about using it proactively and not just in a crisis. And at CHA, we have each of our units. We are designed to have two what we call safe rooms, or originally were designed to be the safe rooms that people are usually used to having, places where, a kid would be physically managed if they needed to be, or you would try to, have it happen there. We found we really didn't need those, and that's when we started implementing the comfort rooms. And comfort rooms were a place for kids to go and de-stress and relax and use OT instead of having to need something like physical management. So it was really a great place that we had on each unit, one of these rooms. Jessica's going to talk a little bit more about how we build our comfort rooms and what goes into that.
Hi, so I'm excited to be able to share this information with you all.
So we have come a really long way, as Gloria described, and so some of our comfort rooms have a lot of different tools and strategies that are going to help our kids to be able to calm themselves down. But what's really important to think about when you're starting comfort rooms are those senses that are going to give that grounding, calming, comforting sensation. So we use a lot of deep pressure to help our kids to feel calm. So things like weighted blankets, using therapy balls or foam rollers. We teach the kids to be able to kind of roll those on their arms and their legs to give themselves some pressure. And then staff are also involved sometimes with giving deep pressure to the kids. So they'll take the therapy balls or the foam rollers and roll them on their backs and their legs. We actually call it steamrolling as a way for them to be able to get that comfort. And we actually have some units that have therapy balls in every single room so that the kids can have access to those tools to use as they need them. Another thing to think about with comfort rooms is that we really want to encourage the kids to have free access to them and to be able to use them as they need them. Because what happens a lot of times is once our kids get escalated, they are not as receptive to using tools. So if we can teach them to identify those warning signs and realize when they're starting to get escalated, or even to help them to understand how our bodies need sensory input, just as we call it a sensory diet. So just as you need nutrition throughout the day, you need sensory input throughout the day. And so as you take in sensory input, it helps you to feel more in control of your body. So when something does happen where you get frustrated or overwhelmed or anxious, you have a little bit more control so you don't get as escalated and get to that point where you are out of control. So using deep pressure and also proprioception, which is the sense that we receive through our muscles and joints. So whenever we're actively using our muscles and joints, so some of the tools that we use for that are things like throwing a medicine ball or wearing ankle weights and doing exercise or yoga. So some of our comfort rooms will have pictures of yoga poses or exercises that they can try out. Another big thing is just keeping your hands busy. So in comfort rooms, a lot of times when kids are using the rooms, they're feeling anxious or frustrated, and so having something that they can hold in their hands. So we offer a lot of different fidget tools. So we have Theraputty or Tangles or different types of stress balls that they can hold. We also have buckets that would have like rice or beans hidden in them so that they can reach inside and having that feeling of being in the rice and then actually having the activity of searching for certain things can be helpful. And involving that visual component can be really good because it's helping to involve the whole body and give you something to keep your mind focused on something. So having like hidden picture puzzles or seek and finds, especially where you can involve, you know, the sense of touch and the sense of vision at the same time can be really helpful. Something in addition to comfort rooms is just really what we've done is worked on building sensory into the routine and the structure of the program so that all of the kids have access to these different types of tools throughout routine. And we also have groups and activities throughout the day that are going to involve activities that provide these regulating sensory inputs. And then the last thing that we've done really to keep staff invested, keep staff learning, and encouraging them is we have OT Task Force. So this is something that we've established at all of the programs at UINC. And this is for any staff that's especially interested in OT. So we have line staff, we have program directors, we have clinicians, all that meet once a month. And during this meeting, one of the things we talk about is inventory. So are there things that have gone missing? Are there things that are broken? Are there things that they are interested in adding to their comfort rooms and to their programs? So we talk about those things. We also do some type of hands-on activity so that they learn something new at each meeting that then they can bring and use on the unit. So this is just a really great way to encourage staff to get excited about OT and to really buy in and feel a part of the program.
Wow. Beautiful summary. Thank you so much. So let's open. I'm sure it has prompted questions from our group. So I'll just open it up for questions.
This is Pat.
I'll go ahead and start. This is Jan.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Pat.
I was just going to ask, what are the ages that are served at Cottage Hill, or are there different tools that are better for different ages?
So we actually have two different age group programs throughout Ewing. So we have latency age that's from about 6 to 12 years old, and then we have an adolescent program that are from 13 to 18. And, of course, you know, with the latency age kids, it's a little bit easier to get them involved in OT, but we really find that these tools, as long as you can get staff to buy in, then the kids are going to buy in. So a lot of our programs, the staff will actually, you know, someone will hold the putty in their hand, someone will be wearing a neck wrap, someone will be holding a weighted ball, so that they see that staff use these as ways to regulate themselves, and they can encourage the kids to get involved in the same ways. We also offer different types of groups where these tools are kind of presented in more of a playful way so that they can kind of just get used to them and normalize them a little bit and help them to feel comfortable with the tools. So then if they are having a hard time, they might be more likely to request the tool.
I'm actually, too, I think it was interesting. We thought that, like, we have an OT classroom in our school at Cottage Hill, and we built a ball pit for the little kids. And within the first month, we actually had to expand the ball pit and make it bigger because so many of our big kids wanted to go inside and it was too small for them. So I think I was surprised at how much of the things that we thought would be just for the little kids, the big kids actually really wanted to use as well.
That's really wonderful.
Oh, it's fantastic. And can you just tell us a little bit, I think you're saying that the children ask to go here, and sometimes the staff might suggest that they go to the comfort room or try one of these activities. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think they can at all times say, like, hey, can I go to the comfort room? Can I go to the OT room? And we also have in our hallways, so we have hallways, the kids' bedrooms are, and in the hallway in each one we have an OT, like, bin that has OT tools in it so the kids can access them during bedtime, or if they're in their bedrooms for, like, room time, we have different activities. So, you know, they can access them that way, but also our staff sometimes if they see a kid struggling or having a hard time, they might suggest to them, hey, why don't we try some OT? It seems like maybe you're feeling a little bit upset. Maybe we can try to regulate again and introduce some OT skills. We also, and Jessica was a huge part, so she probably knows even more about this than I do, and our schoolhouse created different days of the week at one point to introduce different OT skills to kids. And it was
we had Mindfulness Monday, Tranquil Tuesday, Weighted Wednesday,
wow,
Thoughtful Day, and Physical Friday. So it was just a way to pick different tools and strategies for each day, and it was just a 10-minute activity that they would do each day in the school to introduce some of those different strategies and help them, especially where some of our programs are acute and the kids turn over really quickly, but then within a week they learn 5 different models of strategies that might work for them.
Wow.
That's great. That is just great. You guys have really, when I said blaze the trail, you've made the trail. It's really wonderful. Other questions, other comments?
Yeah, this is Steve Torelli. Who provides the training of non-OT staff, and is there sort of an ongoing consultation around the use of the OT resources for the non-occupational therapist staff?
Yeah, so I do at least a once-a-year training. So this is Jessica. I'm the director of occupational therapy. So for UINC, we have 36 different programs, and there's myself and one other OT who are responsible for the whole agency. And we for every program, we do at least one training a year, so that that will help for staff to kind of be refreshed on what OT means, what sensory means, how you can use sensory. They get to learn a little bit about how their senses work so that they can place it a little bit better. And then through OT Task Force, which meets once a month, that's our way of really pinpointing those OT superstars that work in all of the programs to help them to be able to continue to support everyone else in OT. And then also we have implemented kind of like a new employee orientation. So when employees are trained at UINC, they learn OT right as part of orientation. So we actually have some OT bins, and they go through the bins, and they get to try out different tools, and they get a handout on what OT is, and then depending on which program they go to after the orientation, then they might get an even more in-depth training on occupational therapy. Like here at Cottage Hill, we do that.
Mm-hmm. Bella also does a really nice job. She does training for all the staff, but then she also customizes training for different sort of staff level. So like she's done a really great training for our clinicians looking at the impact of trauma on the sensory system and how, you know, trauma really impacts a child's ability to self-regulate and self-soothe. So then we can give that information to the families when we talk about, you know, OT and introducing a sensory diet at home. And I think that's also been, you know, really helpful to sort of think about why maybe this particular youth is having a hard time with sensory regulation.
Wow. For how long have you been doing this? I think you said, but I didn't hear.
So I have been with the agency for 5.5 years. So this model that we have has really been here for about 5.5 years. OT was here before, but it was much more individualized. And since I've come on, we've done much more consultation and tried to, you know, make OT everyone's job.
Mm-hmm. I think before Jessica was here, I was here before that, and OT, it really was, and I say, like, one of the fears that staff had or the hesitations is, like, OT is this thing that an OT does in a room by themselves one-on-one, and that's kind of the model that we had, was we had an OT who would come and meet with the kids, and she had particular kids she was working, you know, with them on goals, and she would let us know how they were doing, but it wasn't something that we all thought, oh, I can do this as well, and I can teach a kid how to, you know, self-regulate using OT skills. So I think that really changed it for us in Jessica's approach.
Wow.
You know, my name really is Ray Wright. Oh, go ahead, buddy.
No, go ahead.
My name is Ray Wright from St. Vincent's Villa, and my question, I might have missed something at the beginning, but my question is around, did you have, what type of rooms did you have before you had the sensory rooms?
So on each unit, we had two, like, safe rooms, which are, like, your old school, like, seclusion rooms, timeout rooms.
Right.
We had two on each unit, and we turned one on each unit into a comfort room instead, because we found that through the use of OT, we were never doing two restraints at the same time. It's just an extremely rare occurrence now that we would ever need to.
And for some of our smaller programs that don't have the ability to change a room into a comfort room, we've done a lot with like sensory carts or sensory bins, so things that kind of live in the hallway of the rooms that have all of these different tools, and then maybe there's a closet that has some of the bigger tools that they have access to and can take out as they need them.
Uh-huh. Okay. And those rooms are located on a unit, or do you have any off the units as well?
So we have it. We try to have it, the tools or a room that are right on the unit, so that it's
right
easy. For some programs that have more space or have really embraced OT, we've created larger sensory rooms that have a lot more equipment, like ball pits and swings and hammocks, so that they can really get the full benefits of sensory input.
Mm-hmm. At CHA, we have both. We have the smaller. Well, we have the smaller sensory rooms, which are our old. Like safe rooms, and then we also have in each of our basements, we usually have like a little area that's a little bit bigger so it can be accessed on the unit, but then in our schoolhouse we have an OT classroom where we turned an entire classroom into like a sensory room, and that's like a bigger space where you can run groups and you can do you know, group different things with multiple kids, whereas your safe rooms are really just big enough for one kid at a time.
And I did I did email Pat a handout that you guys could have access to that has some pictures of our rooms, and we do try to set up the rooms into two separate areas if we have the space. So we have, like, a relaxation area, which is more of, like, our smaller comfort rooms. But for our bigger comfort rooms, we also focus on getting active, so ways where you can actively use your muscles. So we have exercise equipment and trampolines and swings and ways to set up obstacle courses so they can really get their energy out. And we have activity ideas for both of those sections. So there is a handout, and it also lists where we buy a lot of our materials because we really try to be price conscientious, and so we don't really order very often from therapy catalogs, do a lot of shopping from Amazon and Walmart, and look there to see where we get some of our tools.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, this
have
is
you, I'm imagining that since the implementation of this, your frequency of restraints and seclusions and probably other adverse events has gone down dramatically. Is that the case, and have you been tracking that?
I would say yes, it definitely has. I mean, I know that we do our restraint data, and I wouldn't know the exact numbers, but I'm sure it would be possible to pull and see, like, from 5.5 years ago to now, our average number of restraints per month, you know, looking at comparing it with how many bed days, I'm sure has gone down. Because I know even I've been at Cottage Hill for, it'll be 9 years in September, and when I first started, I mean, it was a common thing. I mean, restraints happened every single day. But now I would say, I mean, our acute adolescent unit went a whole month without any holds at one point. Like 2 months, I think they had a month without any. And our long-term unit, typically several times throughout the year, it will go several months without any holds. It's usually when we get a new kid that you'll see a little bit of a spike and then settle down after. But, I mean, I would say there's many days now where we don't have any holds as opposed to before it was every single day there was multiple holds. I mean, we had two safe rooms for a good reason.
Go
ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, I don't know if you've done anything by way of publishing what you found from this the use of OT, but if you haven't, I would really encourage it because it really sounds compelling, and I think there are a lot of people out there who probably have heard a little bit about it but don't appreciate the full impact that OT resources can have with a behavioral health population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Definitely.
I think there was another comment or question.
Yeah, that was me again. How did you shift the mindset of the staff in terms of the utilization of the safe rooms into the sensory rooms? Was there pushback, or what did you do or strategically to help some of the people that may not have been buying into it, if you had any resistance at all?
I think that we had to show them first that OT worked. I think in the beginning they thought, like, yeah, right, this isn't going to work. You're telling me to give a kid who's escalated a weighted ball? Like, they're going to throw it at my head. And knock on wood, it's been very few occasions where I can think of that we actually gave a kid a weighted ball and they threw it at someone's face. But I think we had to show them that it worked, and I think Jessica did a great job at picking out kids that we were just really struggling with and we didn't know what to do, and introduced OT with those kids and saw a drastic difference. And I think through that then, by seeing that we didn't really need as many restraints and we didn't need as many holds, and we told staff, like, we're going to transition one of the rooms over, they were like, yeah, we never used two anyways, because I think they felt confident in the use of OT. You know, I think at first they were like, well, what if we really, really need to use it? And I said, then you can pull out the stuff and use the room, I guess. But, you know, it's very unlikely that you're going to. And I honestly can't think of a time even recently where they had to pull stuff out and try to use both rooms. I mean, occasionally a kid will ask if they can sleep in there. but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I just have one quick question about how you pay for this. particularly the OT staff, because sometimes that might be like on a fee for service. And how have you gone from the individual care to group care and manage the payment?
Are you talking about for OT, like billing,
yes.
or
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
So for actually, my understanding, and maybe it's for the state of Massachusetts, but OT is not a billable service in mental health. So everything that I do is non-billable. So my salary is just built into all of the UINC program salaries. And then we hired one OT through the Caring Together initiative. And so she, her salary is through the group home model, but she doesn't have specifics that she needs to do. So she can do individual, she can run group, because she also is not doing any billing.
Yeah, so up the, up until recently, in Massachusetts, we had the new RFR Caring Together contracts for residential care. Required or now require that we have an OT built into. I think it's for every in group home care and res ed, which are the kids that live here and go to school here. It's required that for every 12 kids, you have to have a part 50% OT. So, and they did include that in calculating your rate hypothetically. So that's the first time though. But we've been. I mean, that was just really in the last
2.5 years.
Yeah. Before that, it was just something that we invested in because we felt as though it was a value to our programs and to, you know. And I think decreasing the use of restraints, I think it ends up saving you money because you don't need to always put on extra staff, knowing that you're going to have to do several restraints.
Very good. Wow. Very, very beautiful summary and discussion. So I really appreciate it so much. Or any last question? Because we ask Gloria and Jessica to be about 20 minutes, and we've taken them over, so I know they have to probably get back. But last questions or comments?
This is Kevin Feisel. I was just wondering if you have any suggested outcomes in addition to the reduction of seclusion and restraints that y'all have looked at as far as the effectiveness of using the comfort rooms in OT.
We actually really haven't done that. It's something that we've talked about, you know, something as simple as like a questionnaire of how do I feel before I use the tool, how do I feel after I use the tool, that kind of thing. But it's something that we have not gotten around to doing yet. Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, if there's already, you know, measures that you're using, of course, you know, you'd have to have a control group maybe, but, you know, those that receive PT, you know, their symptom reduction or whatever, if there's some kind of scale that measures, you know, anxiety or depression or whatever, and we show, you know, greater success with those that are using the OT interventions versus those that don't. Of course, you want to treat everybody, you know, the same. So, you know, I think, you know, if you get baseline and then, you know, you see a significant improvement, it could speak, you know, volumes as to the effectiveness of the OT program. For us, I mean, it and, you know, if we're starting it new, we can get a baseline and you know, it'd work, you know, because we're just starting it up. It'd be a little bit harder for y'all, since you're already 5 years into it. But
yeah, we use the TOP, the treatment outcome package, and we've been using that for a very long time. So I'm wondering if there's something with that, because it would be hard to have a control group now because OT is such a part of our programming. It wouldn't be possible to have a kid in the program who doesn't get OT. But I think I'm wondering if, like, comparing the data from 10 years ago to today, what that would look like.
Or comparing the child's data from admission, I don't know when you do the TTOP, but from admission to discharge, even that, I'm guessing you would see a tremendous change, you know, in the symptoms. I don't know what the TTOP, we have CAFAS, so we use CAFAS, which has some functional scales, and you'd be able to look at, you know, admission to discharge and see the changes.
Yeah, I think you'd probably have to look at, like, so seeing, like, are we making a bigger difference since we implemented OT? Because it'd be hard to differentiate, like, is our treatment already making a difference? Because usually at intake, and we do that, we do it at intake and discharge for our CVETs, but we also base, like, is a kid ready to discharge a little bit on that? I wouldn't, yeah, it's interesting to think about how you could do that.
Yeah.
You could even do length of stay, average length of stay.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a really good point.
All right. Any other comments, questions? Well, thank you, Gloria and Jessica, for really, you've, I'm sure we cannot see our collective heads spinning, but I'm sure they are. I think you've given us a lot to think about. And so we really appreciate it. Are you willing, you know, could folks reach out to you? Like,
yeah, that happens.
Maybe through NACBH? Okay. All right. Well, that would be wonderful because some of us are starting our trails. You know, we're starting the transition. So it would really be helpful to be able to be in touch with someone who's done this and done it so effectively.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much. All right.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, great. Wow. Hard to move on from that, right? Showstopper, right?
Yeah.